First up, however, we're going to discuss some substantial matters arising from the activities of the Joint Defence Facility Pine Gap, and why Australians need not only be aware but concerned. We've been talking about Pine Gap, well, as long as I've been doing the program, but all of a sudden it matters intensely. You may recall the non-violent action of six pilgrims who entered Pine Gap during the night in 2016 to lament and pray for the dead of war. Well, on the night these pilgrims were illegally entering Pine Gap across the world in Afghanistan, 15 civilians were killed by a missile from a US drone attack. They were alleged to have been Islamic State or Daesh militants. Now, these attacks and the history of protests at Pine Gap and my next guest's proximity to the facility have coalesced into a fine new book revealing the strict secrecy surrounding American military presence at Pine Gap and Australia's hardline response to dissent. Kieran Finnane is a founding journalist of the Alice Springs News, established in 1994, now publishing online, and she's the author of Peace Crimes, Pine Gap, National Security and Dissent, published by the University of Queensland Press. And it's good to welcome back an old friend of the program in Richard Tanter. Richard from the Nautilus Institute and the University of Melbourne. Richard is the former chair of the Australian Board of ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and in 2017 they won the Nobel Peace Prize, currently on offer, of course, to Donald Trump, he would have us believe. They won it for drawing attention to the catastrophic consequences of nuclear weapons and for groundbreaking efforts to achieve a treaty-based prohibition of such nasty things. Richard, in parenthesis, could I briefly note that ICAN succeeded in getting the UN to adopt a treaty banning nuclear weapons, and among the countries missing was, shamefully, Australia.
Well, the Australian government has spent no end of time telling the rest of the world how foolish they are and how useless. But in fact, the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, the text of which was passed in 2017 by a vote of 122-1, now has some 80 signatories and some 44 countries which have ratified it and become states party. The treaty enters into force for those countries which have signed and ratified it when 50 countries have so gone through that process. ICAN now expects we will reach that number by the end of this year. And that will mean, of course, Australia hasn't signed or ratified it and has no intention of doing so. But it will have to face the fact that most of its neighbours in Southeast Asia, in the Pacific, and a great many countries of importance around the world that it otherwise chooses to ignore have in fact signed and ratified it and will regard that as a legal prohibition on the use of nuclear weapons, not just the use, the possession, the maintenance, the manufacture, the transfer, and most importantly for Australia, assistance in the use of using nuclear weapons. And of course, Pine Gap is one of our central means of assisting in the use of nuclear weapons, as well as, of course, our extraordinary and mysterious state and defence policy of relying on America's nuclear umbrella to defend Australia.
I suddenly recall talking to Keating on the program, and he was the last Prime Minister to take, in my view, the last to take this issue seriously. And Paul tried his best to get some momentum for banning the bomb, didn't he?
He did. He did very well. He started what was called the Canberra Commission, which had an extraordinary array of global heavyweights, people such as Hans Blix, UN inspections in Iraq, fame, and many other people, including some people who were regarded from the beginning as somewhat conservative, like Robert O'Neill, former head of strategic studies in Canberra, former head of the Institute for Strategic Studies in London, And that report came out and said, we think the answer is the abolition of nuclear weapons, that there is no rational use for them. And, of course, they brought down that report a couple of weeks after the Keating government fell to Howard, and it smelled like dead fish around Canberra, consequently.
Richard, you described the two sets of non-violent activists, the Christians against all terrorism and the six pilgrims who carried out their entry into Pine Gap, as perfect examples of civil disobedience. Why?
Because they went through an extraordinary process. It's most clear in the case of the first group, the Christians against all terrorism. They wrote to their MP, they wrote to newspapers, they wrote to the Prime Minister, they wrote to the Foreign Minister and the Defence Minister. And then when they got to Alice Springs, they wrote a letter to the head of the facility explaining that they were forming a citizens inspection team for trying to verify whether or not there were acts of terrorism being carried out in Pine Gap, by which they meant, of course, supplying data for drone attacks in particular. They bought their equipment, their high-vis white overalls, the bolt cutters they proceeded to use. They bought them quite openly and had a meeting announcing all of this beforehand. So, in other words, they made every effort to not only comply with the law, but to comply with every expectation you might have of drawing attention to something which was absolutely true. And Des Ball and I were asked to help. We didn't initially accept their argument that Pine Gap had a role in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. But when we looked at it closely, preparing for testimony, they were right.
We'll come back to you and Des shortly, but I'm impressed at the thought of these two tiny groups stumbling through the bush in the dark a decade apart.
That's right. I mean, it's really these were very small groups, four people in the first with two supporting people outside, five plus one in the two actions a decade later. This has had an extraordinary resonance. It's really remarkable how much such activities attract a certain kind of derision. And this was Kieran's written about this superbly, catching the tone of prosecutors' condescension and arrogance in the courtroom. But also, I have to say, there are parts of the peace movement which would say, look, Richard, that was who paid any attention to that? This is not something that's going to change the world. We need a mass movement. Well, there are, of course, times when mass movements are important, and I certainly have been involved in that. But there are also the fact that, well, here we are, a decade later, talking about it on national radio, and there's a very fine book that's going to make it clear to many Australians.
Yes, Kieran, you've done a terrific job with the book. Justice John Reeves in Brisbane's Federal Court rejected the Crown's call for custodial sentences, and the six were fined for acts of non-violent civil disobedience between, 1,200 and 5,000, with convictions recorded. This was an outcome that pleased them?
Well, relative to serving time in jail, yes. I believe the courtroom erupted in applause when that was announced. So the prosecution had called for actual time to be served, and the maximum penalty for the offence is 7 years. And in sentencing submissions, the prosecutor had even talked about a non-parole period coming into effect after 3 years. So the possibility of serious time in jail was there, and to be fined was a far more reasonable outcome. Of course, the thing about people undertaking civil disobedience, these committed activists, is that they will accept the outcomes of their action. They were prepared to do jail if they had to. They were prepared to be fined, to be tried and fined or punished. But the fine was the far preferred outcome.
It's without pleasure, I have to remind us, that Kevin Rudd tightened up the laws in 2009, so it's now absolutely watertight in terms of trespass on Pine Gap, and much, much stricter. And sentences for entering the place or photographing the site can now be up to 7 years in prison. Kieran, I'm old enough to vividly recall a priest called Daniel Berrigan and the Berrigan brothers. That resulted in a long jail term, didn't it?
Right through their life, they went in and out of jail, both of those men, as do many ploughshares activists in America. The penalties for this kind of offence in America are much heavier.
Tell us about the origin. Tell me about the origin of ploughshares.
It began during the Vietnam War, protesting the draft of young men to fight that war. And I can't quite remember all of the details of the earliest action.
That's okay, but its lineage, isn't it? Now, Daniel Berrigan was a priest. More recently, an 83-year-old nun has been incarcerated.
Yes, in 2012, she and two somewhat younger men did an action very similar to the Peace Pilgrims at Pine Gap, walked through the night through bushland and trespassed onto a top security uranium enrichment facility that's part of the nuclear weapons arsenal in the United States. And they cut through fences. They penetrated quite far into the facility before finally the penny dropped for one of the guards that something was not right, quite right, and they were tried and jailed. And I think she did 2 years, Sister Megan Rice, her age notwithstanding, 83. It's an extraordinary story.
Some of the best lefties are nuns, of course. Kieran, the reason for the Pilgrims campaign was that unintended civilian deaths were occurring right around the world, which totally undermined American claims of surgical precision, didn't they?
Yes, they placed a strong emphasis on the victims of drone attacks, particularly, I think, were haunted by the sort of terrorising nature of these attacks, of coming out of nowhere when people least expect them, and that they were often simple people in the countryside who were the collateral damage in these attacks. The one I describe at the start of the book, perhaps there were three militants amongst the dead, but the UN itself protested that particular strike strongly and said that the majority of the dead and the injured were civilians.
Richard, to be clear, is Pine Gap absolutely essential to the targeting of these drone missiles?
It's not the only source of information about the location and the character of people who the United States terms targets of interest, but it is one of the most important. Remembering Pine Gap has this, if you like, cartoon form, big ears and big infrared eyes, and those big ears, one of their functions is listening to the phone calls that people make on cell phones or satellite phones. This is a really important source of targeting information about persons of interest, unquote. And Pine Gap carries this out on an industrial scale, particularly in the region from roughly our part of the world through to the edge of Africa. And, of course, that covers most of what the United States is currently interested in militarily. So for strikes in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, in Somalia, in the Sudan, Pine Gap has a very, very important role. It's not the only way they do it, but it is very, very important.
You're listening to Lynn and Earl on Radio National, and my guests are old friend Richard Tander and new friend Kieran Finnane. Kieran, we need to point out that there's no accountability for deaths of civilians or combatants, and there is no compliance at all with international laws or obligations.
Well, there's certainly no accountability in Australia. Any questions to defence or the minister in relation to Pine Gap's involvement in the drone program, as it's sometimes called, they just meet with a wall of silence. There are degrees of accountability in the United States, or at least there were under Obama. I believe that Trump has walked back a lot of that.
Yes, he's handed it back to the military.
Yes, to the Pentagon, yep.
Okay, but let's also remind the listener that only a near certainty of a target status is needed, and that's a standard introduced, sadly, by Barack Obama. But in the countries we're not at war with, these are arguably extrajudicial assassinations.
Yes, because where there is doubt under the principles of international law, civilian status is supposed to be presumed. But the sad fact about international law is that it is only as good as the community of nations will allow it to be. And while the principles developed and discussed, getting nations to sign onto them and abide by them is another whole matter. You know, Australia would say that we are George Brandis, I quote him in the book, said, you know, we are complying with international law in relation to this. Without transparency and accountability, that proposition can't be tested, and it certainly doesn't look like we're complying with international law.
Now, as Malcolm Fraser pointed out, Kieran, there isn't any time limit, no end to the use of drone attacks allowed by the president under US law. This is not good.
No, it's locking the US and with us following them into this forever war that we hear spoken of. And the military mindset now is really has shifted in that direction of conflict, the possibility of conflict permanently upon us as a means of settling disputes.
Okay, let's look at one of the morsels you came across while writing, a 40-page paper by the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2018, stating that the peace war binary is now obsolete. I love this jargon. Instead, there's a continuum of armed conflict. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I just find that so alarming that the ideals contained in the UN Charter that we came to after the horror of the Second World War just seem to have evaporated, and everything now is so is supposed to be so expedient and transactional, and that the absorption of industry into, well, it's been going on for a long time, but as, you know, part of the way that we're thinking about this, I find very unsettling.
And we should also remind the listener that we've got what Marisa Payne describes as the government's heavy investment in the technology of war, almost $200 billion over a decade.
And that was increased recently. So we see a lot of, in the Northern Territory, for example, our government is really signing on to an increased militarisation, especially in the top end, because they see it as a solution to their economic woes. And this is what I meant about the way we are allowing economic and industrial concerns to be part of our thinking in this situation that should warrant the greatest ethical reflection and the greatest amount of hesitation before we move to violent solutions to disputes.
Richard, one is reminded of the famous speech by Eisenhower about the military-industrial complex. Richard, how many strikes are carried out in any year? Do we have a guesstimate?
I can't recall the numbers. I do know that they rose extraordinarily high under President Obama, which was something a matter of enormous regret. They've arisen both carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency and by the US Air Force. And it's particularly, of course, as Kieran has said, not just in countries which at least we are notionally at war with, Afghanistan, we're supposed to be helping, but I kind of feel we're at war with them still, But in countries like Pakistan and Somalia and the Yemen, and the figures are rising all the time. More, as Kieran's suggesting, the military is becoming accustomed to using them. Australia now has armed drones. We haven't used them properly yet, but we have supplied pilots to help out in the Middle East when the Americans, or rather I think it might have been the British, didn't have enough to run them. And on the military-industrial complex, it really is extraordinarily important. The companies that are involved, for example, at Pine Gap, like Northrop Grumman, like Lockheed Martin, the biggest armaments company in the world, a whole series of them, Raytheon, General Dynamics. We have had our former Deputy Prime Minister be a member of the Australian board of some of these companies. This is deeply troubling. And they're only kind of little indicators of what's happening.
Richard, I've just been reminded that Kieran's got some figures in the book, and here's a compelling one. And this is, relates to Afghanistan. In 2019, the figure of drone attacks soared to 7,000. Heavens above. Now, I have to raise this issue about your late colleague Des Ball, who initially believed that the role of Pine Gap was useful to Australia, but changed his mind as a consequence of the use of drones. Richard, is there any function at Pine Gap that is useful to us?
Yes, I think there is. I think it is entirely reasonable that Australia should collect intelligence on, for example, terrorists planning attacks on the Philippines or in the Philippines or in Indonesia, not just attacks on Australians but on anyone. That's a perfectly reasonable thing. I think that the defence of Australia, actually Australia, not Australia in the Middle East or not Australia in Afghanistan, is something to which for which we do need a variety of forms of intelligence.
Are you willing to concede some function of that is reasonable, Kieran?
I actually take my cue from Richard on that at this point in time. I mean, as I'm very attracted to the women's peace movement and the thinking of moving way beyond violence as a way of settling conflicts and dispute, but it'll be a long time before we get there.
We've done programs recently on the circumstances and conspiracy theories swirling around the dumping of the Whitlam government. But Kieran, you describe Australian governments plural, whom no matter who's in power, as the perfectly behaved alliance partner, refusing information and refusing comment.
Yes, I mean, they just couldn't do it better. They're supposed to trot out a meaningless little story about what Pine Gap does, and that's what they do very obediently, and they do very little else. You look at the ministerial statements about Pine Gap, and they are just glowing about this facility and admit no troubling facts whatsoever. Christopher Pine made the last one and suggested that much had been theorised about Pine Gap's involvement in the war on terror, but then just passed on to the next subject. So left hanging was the sense that, you know, there's nothing to see here. But he didn't actually explain or say that it wasn't the case.
Richard, is Australia in the position to pick and choose how it collaborates with the US? For example, could it use Pine Gap to oversee the extremist elements in Indonesia and the Philippines, but declined to have any part in illegal extrajudicial killings in countries where we're not at war?
There are two parts to the answer to that. One is, if we had a government with a spine, then that is probably something that could be entertained. I asked Malcolm Fraser when was the last time he could recall that Australia had used the famous voice at the table at Washington that the alliance is supposed to give us. And he had to think for a while. And he said, I think it was 1955 when Menzies did not agree with John Foster Dulles to go along with American plans for nuclear war over Kumoi and Matsu and attack China. Otherwise, he couldn't think of any. And I think that's right. So firstly, the matter of Spine. The second is that their Pine Gap consists of basically three different systems. And one of them in particular, which is called the Relay Ground Station, which downlinks data from giant satellites over the Pacific through Asia through to Africa with very large, powerful infrared telescopes on them, looking for the heat blooms, the launch of adversary missiles and many other things. That data, however, is not processed at Pine Gap. It just is downlinked, and then in a flash, in real time, literally, it is automatically, remotely passed on to Buckley Air Force Base in Australia, in the United States and Colorado, where they process it, think about it, and decide about it. The point about that, to give the example, is that the same technology which gives the United States early warning of missile attack, the famous presidential 15 minutes to decide how we're going to Armageddon, that same technology also allows the United States to work out which targets have not fired their missiles and thereby become targets for a second nuclear strike. Australia has no hand in that whatsoever.
Is a local Edward Snowden when you need him? Kieran, in Alice, the base is very personal because for decades, Americans have been a part of the Alice Springs community, parents of your kids, classmates, neighbours, and of course, just as many Australians work on the base. It must be embarrassing to ask what people do there.
It's an embarrassment that we avoid at all costs, Philip. And if you do transgress, you are met with a very cold shoulder. So there's an etiquette in Alice Springs. I describe it as not talking about the war.
Well, that sounds, that reminds me of something that John Cleese said.
Yes, exactly.
So there's a strong presence of the Gap within your community. It's in the air.
I would. That's not the case, I don't think, from day to day at all. And it's very successfully kept out of sight, out of mind. The nuclear threat, the potential of it being a military target, Alice Springs, there's virtually no awareness of that, very, very little discussion of that in the community. Let alone a discussion around the responsibility that we might have to be thinking about the way that we host that base and what might be our responsibilities, what we might ask of our government in that regard in terms of accountability, for example. No, it's the consciousness in Alice Springs is very low. Of course, there's a core group of people who are concerned, but overall, not at all. And in fact, the council and the territory government welcome the presence of Pine Gap for the reasons I was referring to before, that it's seen as, you know, vital to the economy.
Yeah.
And they accept that it's vital to national security. They're just unquestioning about that.
Richard, Pine Gap's undergoing a bit of an upgrade, isn't it? There's refurbishment and expansion.
Yes, it never seems to stop. And partly I do it by the strange activity of counting antennas that you can see on Google Earth in similar times. It's now had a major expansion starting in March or early April. Anyone can go on Google Earth and see it. Three big new antennas, probably with radomes. They're not completed yet, or they're not visible yet. This marks a huge expansion of the area, another 24 acres or hectares, I think. There are a sprinkling of smaller antennas, and this indicates new antennas. This indicates that all of the major functions of Pine Gap, its signals intelligence, listening to the secrets of other countries, its what's called overseeing, over, overhead persistent infrared, in the jargon, OPIR, those infrared telescopes on satellites, are watching the wars in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, and of course they're preparing for any kind of war, of course on the Korean Peninsula, but in the event of nuclear war. These are ongoing activities. Both major areas are expanding, particularly that overhead infrared imagery. And all this, is, of course, is now mashed, as they say in the trade, together with geolocation. So one part of Pine Gap helps locate a certain cell phone being used, immediately decrypts what's going on, flashes it to Washington, says this is terribly important, flash back to Pine Gap, which says show us the infrared, and they can't mash that with the photographic imagery and so on. And this is used in a very concrete way now by American combatant commands. It's a long way from the old days of just sending, if you like, national level policy intelligence to the CIA. It goes much further than that now. Pine Gap keeps growing.
Kieran, we're almost at the end of our conversation. What should we be doing now? What should we do next if we're on the side of peace as opposed to war?
Well, a lot more conversation and demands of our government for some accountability and transparency on this. And the reason why I was attracted to write about the peace pilgrims is that they show the power of the ordinary person to act, where it's become so hard when you're banging your head against the wall of silence to get anywhere, for them to act in the way that they did and open up the space to again have this debate and again make these demands. I think that's what we have to do next.
What do you think, Richard? What's your argument?
Well, I think, firstly, Kieran's given a voice to a lot of pain and thinking about Pine Gap over half a century. I think that the first thing we have to do is really call on the ALP to recognise that Australia should be signing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons.
Oh, fair go,
that's
Richard.
Right, I know, but
give
I think we've got to have some ambition.
Give us a break.
And I think, in fact, that although Pine Gap is a very large measure of assistance to nuclear war under the terms of the treaty, there is actually a pathway whereby the most egregious involvement of Pine Gap in nuclear war, namely that relay ground station for the overhead infrared imagery, that's the most direct connection we have to nuclear war. And, in fact, Pine Gap is redundant in that. That relay ground station, in which we have virtually no human involvement, in fact has been made redundant quite intentionally by the United States because Pine Gap's so vulnerable. The reason is that they have built satellite-to-satellite cross-links, and so that data, now linked automatically and remotely through Pine Gap, could in fact go from one satellite to another, and then down to Colorado. Australia does not have to be involved in that that involvement of Pine Gap in nuclear war. And I think that's a lesson the ALP could really think about. Now, that's not the end of the story by any means.
Okay.
But it's the most egregious part, and there is a pathway.
Well, it's a bumpy pathway, but thank you
it
both
is,
for coming
right.
on. Kieran, terrific job. Kieran Fennane, journalist and author of Peace Crimes, published now by Queensland University Press and the latest recipient of the Koala Stamp, and Richard Tanter, from the Nautilus Institute and Melbourne University and former chair of IPAN.